now aware of the soil food web and trying to get that soil food web going. The soil food web is like us, it needs feeding. So the photosynthesis, when we go to grassland, feeds the soil food web. When that grass dies off or the ground becomes bare, we've got zero photosynthesis, so we're putting our whole soil food web into starvation. The landscapes like Duke's Plain, where we've got a good cover of trees over the whole landscape, no matter how dry it gets, no matter what happens, that country is photosynthesizing every day of the year. So there's always some feed into the soil food web. It may at times only be from the trees and shrubs, but it is a feed into the soil food web. And then when we come out, when we get the rains on that country, it bounces into action, bang, straight away. It's so, the recovery is so quick. It's almost instantaneous. I've seen it time and time again. Within 21 days, we've got a full profile of grass across the whole farm. And you see that, you think of it and you think it's impossible, but I've seen it happen so many times, and I've seen that happen coming out of a dry time where our pastures are in better condition than they were going into it. And we can actually start to use these dry times as a really powerful tool to get successional shift in our pastures.
And when you consider what you just said, 21 days for recovery versus, and sometimes farmers who really abuse their property might take two rain seasons to get back to what you just said in 21 days.
So I suggest with that headline of, you know, getting the farmers to walk off their land.
Yeah, because of drought.
How powerful, what are the possibilities if we can educate those people and give them the skills to manage those landscapes?
Yeah.
To get this water infiltration, to get this perenniality in the grass, to get these quick recoveries. What impact is it going to have on us as a nation, you know, across our whole landscape? It's just huge. Yeah. Well, getting them to walk away. I can show you places down on the Murray where the government's bought back the water rights and they've just turned the water off. And it's just like a desert. They have walked away from those places and everything's just died there. Yeah. Nothing's going. Yeah. That's not a solution. Absolutely not. But yeah, to get back on track now with Syntropics. As you know, Hugo, I spend a bit of time travelling around the country facilitating workshops and field days. So I see a lot of landscapes. I see a lot of different industries, whether it's grapes or whether it's dairying, whether it's beef, whether it's cereals. And I guess I see the regenerative, organic, biodynamic, you know, and largely we've become quite comfortable with that concept. So 10 or 15 years ago, when we floated some of these ideas, there was this massive conflict and headbutting. People saying, you can't do that, you can't do that. Mm. I remember when, if you said 10% of trees on the landscape, farmers would just headbutt you, tell you how wrong you are. And so in biodynamics, organics, synthropics, or regenerative, we've all become comfortable. So everybody's going along with what we're saying. There's no more of this challenging. And it's a comfort spot, and out of a comfort spot, we really don't create anything. So I've had the concept of what's known as syntropic farming or successional agroforestry or abundance agroforestry. It comes under a number of names. Don't be confused with syntropic, that is to do with the tropics. It's syntropic to do with syntropy, which is building up, as opposed to a lot of our systems which operate in entropy, which is running down. So I trotted myself off to a syntropic farming two-day workshop, and it was so good. It was all this headbutting was going on again. Like it's radical enough to really challenge us. And it's out of that challenge or that headbutting, it gets us out of our comfort zone. So it gets us out, way out of the comfort zone where the magic unfolds. And I'm seeing syntropic farming as one of the next big breakthroughs in agriculture or gardening. And, you know, you say to anybody in Australia, you say, oh, look, I'm growing lettuce under gum trees, they will straight away tell you you're wrong and you can't do it. But it's done, it's happening, it started, this movement started in Brazil 30-odd years ago, and there's people doing it. So you can, in my case here, this farm is pretty treeless. I've just got biodynamic certification. The auditor said, there's one thing stands out about this farm is it's got a lot of paddocks with no trees in it. I said, we're working on amending that. And so I'm moving into the syntropic methodologies. And so if I go into a paddock and I say, okay, I want to plant a third of this paddock to trees, as we all know, planting trees on farm comes at a cost. There's preparation, there's management of the trees, there's buying the trees, blah, blah, blah. So it comes at a cost. But hey, if I'm growing vegetables underneath those trees when I plant them, so I'm planting radish, coriander, rocket, so vegetables with a 45-day life cycle, within 45 days I'm harvesting a cash crop. And then I've got other stuff in there that's got a 90-day life cycle. So I've got this 45, 90, 120-day, I've got this harvest going on. So within 45 days, I'm starting to pay for my trees that I've planted. So it's very early days here. I'm about 3 months into this process. I've planted now probably 150 trees in a trial plot. So I'm perfecting the early establishment, which here for me is using water to get it started. But I'm trusting that once I get it established, that it will create its own water, life creates water, and that I will be able to go into a paddock, establish a third of it into trees, get a cash harvest out of there in that first year. And then after that, I can do what I like with it. I can take it back to ground zero and grow vegetables there again, or I can start to manage those trees for saw logs, for firewood, for just biomass to go on the ground. And I'm actually planting my trees a metre apart. So very close spaced trees, and they're all totally disposable. So I can manage them for saw logs, or I can manage them just to chop them back onto the ground, what permaculture guys call chop and drop. So I'm in the process here of just perfecting the learning, I guess, the establishment system. And then once I get a system that's working, it'll be just, I'll be going for it flat out to try and amend my lack of trees.
And it really gets down to a furphy that was sold to the farmers back in around 1970, that farmers have got to get big, and more recently farmers have been told to be more efficient, in other words, buy the farm next door or buy a bigger bit of machinery or a rotary dairy in or whatever. And what do you think of what that? I know it's, so that's where what you're saying now, that statement of, you know, get big and get out and being more efficient is just, it's not what farmers should be aiming for.
Well, I guess it comes out of the industrial farming model, Hugo. For me, I remember reading something quite a few years back in the Stockman and Grass Farmer about some guy who was really big in dairying in the States, and he retired, and somebody's asked him, if you were to do it again, would you do it differently? He said, yeah, I would do it way differently. I'd have just a small number of cows and produce really quality product. And I guess that's where I'm going. I've got off the Duke's plane trip and feeding the world with beef. I'm back here onto a smaller scale. So I've come back from 3,500 hectares to 140 hectares. And I'm looking at producing high quality beef, high quality hay, and vegetables to go into into the local market. So very much a smaller scale, but a multitude of enterprises. It won't be just beef, it won't be just hay. It'll be heat, hay, vegetables, beef, and I can bring things like chickens and pigs and all sorts of stuff into it.
Another very important thing is bees, because in Australia you can hire out bees to the almond growers for $100 a hive. In America it's $300 US, but I'm not suggesting you hire them out to the almond people at all, but it's because pollinators are something of lends itself with syntropic farming.
Yeah, I think that the thing around pollinators, if you look at specific things like almonds, it's essential to have bees there. Unfortunately, a lot of these industrial kind of almond orchard type things where people move bees in, they also use some pretty heavy chemicals there, so they can be the enemy of the beekeeper.
In America, they found they lost 50% of their hive in numbers after they've been in the almond crops.
Yeah. So it comes at a price working in industrial agriculture and chemical agriculture. Mm-hmm. I kind of see here that the bees are one of our potential enterprises on this farm, but we'll take nothing from the land, we'll just add to it. And I think currently there's no biodynamic certified beekeepers in Australia or New Zealand. So there's kind of a window of opportunity sitting there for somebody to jump on and go with the to go with. So there's opportunities in agriculture. It's just a matter of being able to get out of the comfort zone and explore them.
I think the farmers have got to challenge their beliefs, where their beliefs have come from, and sort of move more into knowledge and start questioning their own beliefs.
That's, I guess, the learnings, you know, some of the learnings I had growing up in agriculture and in the beef industry have been the most challenging things I've had to deal with. I remember my father, who was regarded as a good manager, his strategy when the rainfall was low was to open every gate on the place and let the cattle go where they wanted to. Now, I grew up thinking that was the way to go, and I still fight that learning even after many, many years of cell grazing and the benefits of rotation and resting. I still have a gene in me that wants to open all the gates. So getting out of those early learnings is a really challenging process.
Yeah. When you've got hungry animals and you've got a paddock full of feed, it's pretty easy to abuse that paddock, which is not ready to be grazed yet.
Yeah. Just open the gates, no management, just walk away and let the cows. And unfortunately, that just takes the landscape backwards.
Exactly. And it's costing. Shane, thank you very much. Would you like to have a parting word on a message for the farmers, or any parting word that you'd like to put forward?
I guess my wind up is the mantra I'm using now is live in the question. Continue to ask questions. When somebody gives you an answer, or when you find an answer, unfortunately, it shuts everything down and there's no room for any more. So to live in the question, and then information will come in. But for God's sake, don't get answers. Once you get an answer, it shuts everything down. Live in the question. And so whatever's going on, it's like the dry, the lack of rain. What are the opportunities in this? What are the infinite, you know, possibilities? What are the unlimited opportunities in this current weather condition? You know, the same when it rains buckets. What are the opportunities in that? Don't just conclude because it's dry, we'll all be ruined, said Hanrahan. And don't just conclude when it rains that it'll all be good because we've had rain. Continue to ask questions about what you're doing. It's such a powerful process.
Shane, thank you very much indeed. And I hope that people who are listening to this, and we've got it recorded, go back to it, because there's many layers in what you had to say. It's not, it's very easy to listen to words and, as you said, draw a quick answer, but there's a lot of depth in what we've just covered. So thank you very much, Shane.
Thanks, Hugo. And the parting one is with this dry, is just ask yourself, how does it get any better than this?
Yep. Jolly good. Thank you very much, Shane. All the best.
Bye.
Bye.